Good evening. Welcome to The Pipeline. This is the Western Standard's weekly panel show where we talk about some of the top issues going on in the week, analyze them, dissect them, make sense of them if we can. My name is Corey Morgan. I'm a columnist with the Western Standard, and I'm joined today by, starting on my right, our opinion editor, Nigel Hannaford.
Hello again. Yes. Always good to be here, isn't it, Corey?
Good to have some consistency with Absolutely. These shifting faces on the pipeline week by week, but still, it's a good to have some fresh
faces.
Always
upholding here, those same right ideas.
Ah, yes, of course. And on the end, we got Sean Pulzer in. We've been pulling in remotely onto this show. Now you got the nice comfort of being here in person. Welcome to.
Well, thank you, Corey.
Yeah.
Nice to be here.
We've got a lot to go on about today. I guess, you know, we're going to start with Sean today because you went, they sent you out in the field or you chose to go there and catch some of those carbon tax protests that were going on over, they were across the country, but a pretty big one west of Calgary.
Yeah, just over on the Trans-Canada Highway at the Petro-Canada, you know, it's a pretty quick stop on the way out to the ski hill for Calgary residents. There was, at one point, there was about 500 people that were out and about and fairly seasoned crowd, I would say, veterans of the Freedom Convoy to Ottawa, and the main organizer was Freedom George, who actually went to jail for his role in committing mischief, even though he was sentenced to 6 months probation, I think. But it was all in all, it was fairly well organized. They got their point across, even managed to they didn't block the highway per se, but you know, they've got these tactics where they get the trucks rolling with flags and they slow her down to 30. And you know, even though they were supposed to keep one lane open,
slow rolling.
Yeah. But so by the end of the day, apparently the lineup was about four or five clicks backed up, passed up the overpass, and the police came in, the Mounties with I don't know where all the police officers came from, but I went down there yesterday and apparently they had tactical teams and they had big vans, and it was a real major effort. There still hasn't been any confirmation from the police whether I would imagine like they would have had to bring people in from outside their detachment. But it was part of a series of protests that were going on. There was at least three other ones in Alberta. There was one up in Jasper. There was another one in Crow's Nest Pass.
Yeah. Well, it was just a fluke of timing. I knew there were going to be some, but I didn't pay close attention because I had to run off to Vancouver for something much more important for the weekend. But I was driving back and I hit that protest eastbound, which wasn't so bad. It slowed us down a little bit. Boy, they really, really did back things up. But as for the title, you know, it didn't really move the needle, though. I mean, it might help people express themselves and get it out there and bring it back into the news. But Nigel, I mean, what do you think? Was this what you could call a successful demonstration?
No, not really. I don't mean to pour cold water on the efforts of these guys, because we all believe the same thing. You know, we think that the tax is excessive, it shouldn't be there, it's poorly motivated. I could go on in the opinion columns. I have gone on at length. The only thing is, if I was I'd be on their side when I got to the start of the slow roll, but by the time I four miles later, when I've been cut back and held up, I'm starting to get tired of it. So if you irritate your friends, is it a success? It didn't cause any fuss or discombobulation to Mr. Trudeau, and he's actually the one that we really want to get the message to. This just didn't do it.
Yeah, well, it was peaceful, at least. They weren't being, you know, out of control.
Yeah, no, it wasn't bad in that sense.
But it was boisterous. It was, you know, there were plenty of I can't say it on the air. You know, we've all seen the signs, the Trudeau signs.
Yeah. And people vocalize it.
Vocalizing it.
You put the asterisks in to change the
asterisks. Yeah.
But at least it was a rural area. You know, I mean, it backs up a lot of people. I mean, that's a busy highway on a long weekend. But I mean, the protests, you get out, you make noise, you're on the side, fine, you make the evening news. You should move on. A problem a lot of protests have, and I think these guys had it, they were back again yesterday, though.
Yes.
So, like, you know, how long are they going to hold this out? I mean, it sounds like today they've given up, but they overstay their welcome, it seems, I think, sometimes.
Yeah, well, you know, some people had made the comment, you know, that, you know, this is a protest. You know, protests are supposed to inconvenience people.
Yeah, but not your friends.
you can have a pretty tough time not offending somebody around here then.
Well, somebody's always going to get upset. But your point, though, is to bring attention to an issue and build. I mean, you really do want to build a degree of public support. You'll never win everybody, but you want people to look at that and nod their heads and say, I agree with what these guys are doing. But yeah, if you go out and just keep poking your finger in everybody's eyes and you're that abrasive, you're not helping your cause. You're maybe helping yourself vent. But
well, and that's about it. No. This energy has to be translated into political action ending in a vote. And keep the pressure up by all means. Keep harassing your MPs. I mean, it's not a problem in Alberta. I don't think there's an Alberta MP other than one in Edmonton who might actually support a carbon tax.
Well, one in Calgary, too, who does support a carbon tax.
Right, well, okay, so there's two. You know, like this isn't, we have to change the hearts and minds back east and get people out there. Maybe, I don't know, just maybe another ring around Parliament Hill for a weekend. What do you think?
Well, I was impressed that, there were these similar protests even in Quebec, you know, which has its own carbon price scheme and, ostensibly supports the carbon tax. Even in British Columbia, some gas stations lowered prices to 2008 levels, which was about $1 a liter, because that was the year that they introduced their own carbon tax. The Crow's Nest Pass protest drew people from Sparwood and some of those communities in the Elk Valley. So, you know, it wasn't by any means just restricted to Alberta and Saskatchewan. There were protests in Nova Scotia. There were protests in New Brunswick, Newfoundland. And apparently the response was pretty similar all the way through. Like they included a similar show of force from the police and, you know, just telling people to back off and that kind of thing.
Yeah, just raising the level of mass consciousness across the country is a good thing. That's, as I say, maybe keep one lane open a little more open than it was.
So. You can do it. I mean, just to close it, like, as I said, I happened to be almost a passerby. I said, I didn't know what was going to be happening there at that time. And I would have been just as impressed if I'd just seen 500 people on the side of the road, waving signs and flags without backing up the traffic. I said, wow, that's a lot of people getting off their butt on a long weekend when they could be doing other things to express themselves. I just don't feel they needed to piss everybody off, to be blunt about it.
Did you honk?
No, because I was just trying to pull through as things were. But I guess, you know, people have to express themselves. And as things go, I mean, it's finished now, and there were certainly no big clashes with police or anything like that. So it was good as far as that went.
The police probably don't like paying carbon tax either.
No, and I don't think they, despite what some people might think, they don't like wading in on protesters and swinging the batons and breaking them up if they can avoid it as well.
The other point that we got to get across is the fundamental deceit of saying, look, you're getting more back than the tax that you are paying. First of all, it is not true. Notwithstanding the earnest protestations of the Prime Minister, the truth of the matter is that that is a taxable, those checks are taxable, are they not?
I'm not sure.
I believe they are.
I just filed my taxes. I got $900.
And then part of it, too, is you pay GST on the carbon tax.
It's a tax on
the whole
tax.
Thing is that the general raising of prices through inflation caused by the truckers, the farmers, the food producers, and everybody else passing on the carbon tax they pay, there is no way that those checks that the government sends you are anywhere close to what you are paying out.
Well, the other issue is how effective it actually is. There was a report from, I believe it was the Clean Energy something, CES centers. You know, they're very pro carbon tax, but by their estimates, a consumer carbon tax only accounts for about 3% of the emissions reduction. You know, in terms of the pain that it's causing.
That's the other end of it. It's not changing the climate.
It's not moving the needle. No.
Well, let's go on to something else that isn't moving the needle, and that's the Chinese, the inquiry finally sort of kind of into the Chinese election interference or foreign election interference. We're starting to get some questions at least. It's come back into the news scroll. What's going on over there, Sean?
You know, I haven't really followed this one closely, although I am familiar with the Chinese community. I suppose what struck me as odd was our columnist Linda Splodian, you know, kind of said it best, is that, you know, they haven't managed to really make any inroads in this investigation, even though they've been doing it now for, what, 2 years? But yet at the same time, they were investigating election signs from, you know, our friends over at Rebel Media there. You know, somehow it seemed to take a higher priority. It was, you know, when you're tarnishing the image of the prime minister as opposed to actual real bona fide election interference.
Yeah, Linda always puts it excellently. And you know, the double standard. I mean, this apparently just doesn't seem to be important to the government. What do you think, Nigel? I mean,
well, you know, there were quite a few things that came out yesterday that I don't think anybody was really anticipating. One was that, according to the testimony, campaign directors for the federal parties in the 2021 election were not warned about the possibility of Chinese interference in specific ridings, even though Canadian intelligence was aware of it and had briefed the government. The Conservative campaign co-chair in the 2021 election is he's a very high-powered lawyer in Norton Fulbright, I believe, Waleed Solomon. And his liberal co-part confirmed at the inquiry that they were never given that level of detail during the top-level security briefings. This was despite the intelligence officials assessing months earlier that there was a likely risk of foreign interference. So that's one thing that was a surprise. It was also interesting to note that Erin O'Toole, who led the party at one point, stated that Chinese foreign interference could have influenced up to 9 ridings.
Well, I remember Conservative MPs were being harassed. Their families were being harassed in Hong Kong.
And that was fairly public knowledge. We kind of knew that already, but this is for O'Toole coming out and saying they have, like, they've all got their own internal polling. They've got a rough idea how they're going to do. Mm-hmm. And basically, there were about 9 where it was so different to what they predicted that obviously, to them, obviously, something had gone on. So what? Hard to know. And this isn't the other thing. It's not a strictly electoral matter, but the way that the Liberals choose their candidates, I guess you could be 14 years old and vote in a Liberal nomination. So it was busloaded.
That was with the Han Dong.
Yeah.
Again, his story started to change, you know. At first, I'm a victim. And, I didn't know that this was untoward, that busload after busload after busload, somebody who might have been behind that. Or, the Dong's hanging out. You can't believe him.
And the Chinese community, they have their own social media channels. Like, they've got their WeChat, and pretty much everybody, whether they're Canadian or not, is tied into it. And it's definitely monitored by the Communist Party, you know. So, like, there's almost like back channels where they could convey this message. And some of the Chinese language media, and, you know, they're small little community papers in the Chinatown and that kind of thing. And I'm not suggesting by any means that they're affiliated with the Communist Party, but the Chinese community is pretty tight in this, you know, in this country, and it's there. A lot of them have direct connections back to relatives and that in the mainland, and more and more of them are coming from the mainland now. Like, almost all the immigration used to be from Hong Kong, so. I'm not questioning their sympathies or their loyalties, but there's definitely a lot of back channels that we're probably not privy to.
No, I mean, at least some stuff's finally coming out of this inquiry. So, I mean, we can analyze and chew on it. I mean, because we've gotten really nothing for you know, foot dragging and hiring friends and doing everything they could. At least some people are now starting to bring out some new documents and information, and hopefully we get closer to trying to figure out just what the heck is going on.
Well, I mean, hopefully we do. That's the frustrating thing about these processes, and I think it's intentional that that you get a hint of what happened, then it's denied, and then you sort of move on to the next thing, and then, well, I guess eventually the commissioner will report, and that's probably going to be after the next election at the rate things are going, and
hoping people will forget.
And hope people will forget.
I'm afraid they might. I hate to, you know, with the Canadian interest levels on subjects can be a little myopic at times. So, I mean, going on, the campaign feels almost like it's started already, even though it could be a ways away. We'll talk shortly with our guest on that. But it just seems every day the Prime Minister is announcing another spending initiative on something that I don't recall any of us really asking for, and often not even in his jurisdiction. He's reaching into my wallet and he's handing part of it back to me and saying, here, look how kind and generous I am. Is he fixing any problems?
Well, no. And, you know, this kind of goes back to rebranding the carbon tax a rebate. You know, it's like, is this, you know, a program to reduce emissions, or is it a program to redistribute wealth? And I would say that some of these housing announcements that they're coming up with, too, kind of seem to be almost a redistribution of sorts, you know, except now he's trying to put it for younger people who, you know, quite frankly, probably don't have any hope of ever being able to own a home. And if you're under 35, your chances of probably ever owning a home in this country and the circumstances are slim to none. Right. So what are you going to do? Hand out, you know, $15 billion for construction loans and build apartments and like what, just to put a roof over your head? It's like, okay, you know, it seems to be a pretty low bar.
Well, that's it. And I will expand a bit more on that. Like this $15 billion injected, it doesn't bring anybody's rents down. It doesn't help the market. We're maxed out. We've got a lot of issues hindering construction and slowing them. It hasn't been for lack of capital. It kind of gets to me too, where they're talking about they're going to change the credit ratings, you know, have rent applied to your credit rating to help you get a place. If you're 25 and you're looking at a $1.7 million house in Vancouver, it doesn't matter how good your credit's going to be, you're getting in. Is this $15 billion bunch of loans is going to help anything, Nigel?
Well, first of all, it's over several years. This is not like next month we're going to put 15.
But that's when the people need the houses right now.
Okay. Yeah. That's the first thing. The second thing is, if you do the math, it looks to me like it's about $500,000 a unit. So how many are you really going to get? They say 30,000 units. Well, gosh, we could rent 30,000 units now if we had them to rent. And the other thing that this doesn't is, who is going to build these things? It's not like there are a bunch of bricklayers and concrete pourers and finishing carpenters sitting around wondering where the next job is coming from.
No,
they are all going flat out. So you can put all this money out there and you're still not going to get anything built because everybody who knows how to do it is busy already.
Well, ironically, it could bring the prices up because then you bring bidding wars for the tradespeople to get the places built.
Sure.
The only way to compensate for that is to raise the price downstream for the rent or the sale of the properties.
Well, I was just going to say this, $500,000 for a unit. I mean, geez, over in Northeast Calgary, you can buy an apartment for $250,000. You know, like those seem to be pretty expensive apartments.
Sean, this program goes out nationally. Don't tell the whole country that you can buy something for $250,000 in Calgary.
You know, we're talking about a one-bedroom crash pad.
Swept away in the rush.
You know? Yeah.
That's
you're up in Skyview Ranch. You don't mind those, you know, 747 tires tapping on your roof on the way. That's where you get the affordable apartments.
Oh, well, there you go. That's why they're 250.
No, look, I mean, there's something a lot of people don't understand about this because I had to watch Mr. Trudeau making this announcement this morning.
Yeah, you were forced to. We were forced to watch it.
Yeah, you know, against my will. But But he talks about getting the provinces, and I hate this expression, we've got to get the provinces to step up. Everything is always about stepping up, as if, you know, anyway, that's a linguistic thing. The point is, the provinces would be stepping up if the federal government had not hosed them about 30 years ago. What happened was that they sold the provinces on national health care with a federal contribution of 50 cents on the dollar. That was back in the last century. Then when they got into trouble in about 30 years ago, they said, well, we're not doing that anymore. Now it's only 15 cents on the dollar. There were howls of protest, but what were you going to do? Well, what they had to do was keep the level of health spending up, because that's the one thing that can get you diselected faster than anything else, is cutting back on health spending and having people dying on gurneys. So all the provinces used the financial room that they had, which is not unlimited, to keep the health system running. So all the other things that provinces would like to do were very much cut back by the effects of this federal action. And one of those things was the ability to actually take control of housing policy. So calling on the provinces to step up is the height of a number of things, but hypocrisy is the first thing that comes to mind.
Well, you can't step up when the federal government's cut off your feet.
Exactly.
So getting onto that federal government, they're grossly unpopular. Lots of people eager to get their chance to express that at the ballot box. But that might not be as soon as we even think. I mean, a lot of us, people think there's that fixed date coming up a year and a half from now in fall. But constitutionally, that's not necessarily all that fixed. Actually, that's just policy. That's not constitutional. So we thought we'd bring somebody in who suffered through many years in Parliament to learn those ins and outs and all that constitutional stuff and policy stuff. We got Jay Hill in here, and he'll kind of explain that our hopes for getting rid of this government in a year and a half might be dashed. How's it going, Jay?
Hey, very well. Thank you, Corey.
So not everybody necessarily understands. Perhaps if you can kind of explain how this works, because, you know, there's the constitutional obligation for when an election has to be held. Then there's the legislation they put in for when they say an election's going to be held. But those aren't necessarily, you know, the case, right?
Exactly. Yeah, we've got this, I'll call it a system of law in this country where we've become used to having a federal election roughly every 4 years, and the date is set after the most recent election, so that primarily the governing party and the prime minister can't play with the date to suit their own needs, which is what would happen before we had these so-called fixed election dates. However, because they don't align with the Constitution, specifically Section 50, where a government can wait 5 years for an election, it's really still up to the prime minister. And we've had a couple of cases in the last number of years where prime ministers have called an election before the fixed date. We just had in the government or in the House of Commons, Corey, the government bring in a new bill whereby they'll delay the next election 1 week in October of 2025, so that a whole raft of MPs qualify for the pension plan, which they wouldn't have otherwise qualified for. So there's still ambiguity, I guess I'll call it, about when the election will be. So we could have a whole discussion about that. But as far as I know, the prime minister could still at some point over the next year and a half further delay it up to a year. And the only time I'm aware that that's happened in my lifetime was the first two elections I was involved in. And ironically, it was also when a governing party, in that case, the Progressive Conservatives, were incredibly unpopular, and they delayed the election for up to 5 years, or almost 5 years. I think they were about a month short. And Kim Campbell suffered the worst defeat in electoral history. So I don't think delaying it a year will save Mr. Trudeau or his government, but it'll certainly do a tremendous additional year of damage to our country.
Well, that it could. What do you think, Nigel? Do you think Trudeau, out of desperation, would go for it?
Depends what his friends in the NDP let him do, really. if I were Mr. Singh, I would be upping the price considerably for my continued support. Because let's face it, when Mr. Trudeau goes, Mr. Singh is going to be following him. This is not going to end well for the NDP. Jay was saying that they were a month short of 5 years. If you go back to the end of the Second World War, they actually managed to make it from the March 1940 to June 1945. So that was actually, but that was a very exceptional circumstance, a war, a world war. And so other than that, other than the instance that Jay mentioned, it's been every 4 years since the end of the war, since 1945. So I have to think that the public reaction to a legislated change, to make it 5 years, would be furious. Peaceful protest would be widespread, boisterous, and it may be,
block a few
more
roads
than just cars slowed down a few miles an hour. If you thought that the Freedom Convoy was a lot to handle in Ottawa, well, try going another year with this desperately unpopular government. But they could tough that out. My anxiety would be that in that year, knowing that they were going down in flames at the end of it, they would live every dream they ever had and cause harm to this country, both in terms of its sense of self-worth, but also obviously in the economy. I don't know whether we'd ever be able to haul ourselves out from it. And I bet that this is something in the back of his mind.
Well, getting further from that, and I was chatting with Jay a bit before the show, and another real scary scenario. Now we're kind of getting out there, but you never know with, especially this day and age. Well, let's say they stretch it the extra year. People go pretty bananas. We have a lot of protests and disorder and things happen. Well, that could lead to, there's one more way to extend it even beyond 5 years, and that was mentioned in World War II. They changed it from the name of the War Measures Act, call it the Emergencies Act, which we recently saw it imposed for protests. Jay, conceivably, the Emergencies Act could extend it even further, couldn't it?
Well, absolutely. And we've seen that happen, for example, in Venezuela. And this gives me a chance to plug my most recent column, which Western Standard has graciously ran in your publication, because I talk about this, and it's not as far-fetched as people would think. I mean, we look at what this government has done during its, I would call it a false mandate. You know, nobody expected that the NDP would effectively give Trudeau a majority government. And yet that's what's happened. Nigel mentioned whether Singh would allow this government to go on an additional year after the 4 years. Well, everything we've seen thus far would indicate he will. And you were also talking earlier, gentlemen, about the ongoing carbon tax protests. And I would argue that if they want to be effective with these protests, where they should be is in the NDP members of parliament's ridings. And I've said this for quite some time. Put pressure on those MPs to revolt against Singh. That's the only way this government is going to fall. And, so if you want effective protests, get into those ridings, get into those MPs' faces, and ask them why they don't stand up and force their NDP colleagues to vote non-confidence in this government. And then it will end. And I think that would be an effective protest and could be done, especially because I have personal experience being a so-called dissident and rebelling against a leader. So I know it can be done. It's not a comfortable position to be in, but the NDP could do that if they so chose.
I just wanted to make a comment because Jay mentioned a magic word there, and that was mandate. So my 16-year-old daughter is doing model parliament up in Edmonton this weekend, and we were talking in the car the other day, and she said, Dad, what's a mandate? So I kind of had to try to. So she said, is that like permission? And I said, well, like we're in this position now where this government is so unpopular, like, you know, that it really doesn't have a mandate anymore to do anything. And that what it reasonably should do is call an election, like now, you know, just to clear the decks and get it out of the way. So I just was kind of impressed that Jay kind of brought up that word mandate, you know, and the fact is that this government has none. And I would argue that that extends over to the NDP as well.
Well, and those cracks in loyalty, and as Jay mentioned, I mean, we remember the difficulties under Stockwell Day. Conservatives are always quick to speak up when they've had it with their leadership and do what they feel it takes to for better or worse, change the situation. But the loyalty among the Liberal caucus has just been astounding, as well as with the NDP. I mean, we know that some of those NDP members of parliament find it galling that they're in bed with the Liberals on this. They have their socialists. They want to move farther left, but they just won't utter a peep. Like, what does it take, Jay? I understand you're saying, let's put some pressure on them or have those protesters put the pressure on those NDP members. That could be the weak link that would finally, you know, take this coalition apart. But do you think they'll ever actually budge?
Well, I think that one of the deciding factors for them to take action, Corey, might be if the protesters in their ridings were able to generate enough support from their own constituents so that those members of parliament know that whenever the election happens, they're toast, that they're never going to get reelected. They're going to lose their job. And that despite the fact that they now apparently will qualify for their pension, they're going to lose their job. They're going to become unemployed. And for many of those MPs, it's the best job they've ever had. So I think there should be ways to put pressure on them so that even if they do it behind closed doors and put pressure on their own leader during caucus meetings, we need to see a change in the support, the blanket support that Singh has been giving to Trudeau. Because as you say, they don't, or your other guest said that this government does not have a mandate. And yet they're forging ahead on multiple fronts to impose laws on Canadians that I would argue the vast majority of Canadians do not support. So it's an abominable situation. And it's a real problem if we end up with a government that uses open protest like they did with, I would argue, peaceful protests in Ottawa with the Freedom Convoy to impose martial law, which would even allow them to ostensibly shut down this program that we're participating in right now. Should they choose, they can do whatever they want. And that's absolutely frightening. And so I've been grappling for quite some time with just how far will this prime minister and his government, with the support of the NDP, go? You know, how low will they go, effectively? Perhaps you guys can enlighten me as to what you think, how far he's going to proceed.
Only time is going to tell at this point. I guess we'll all morbidly watch and hope for the best and then put pressure on how possible. Our system just makes it darn difficult to do much between elections. That's kind of part of what my column was about. You know, before I close off, you know, Jay, yeah, you've been providing columns for us here at the Western Standard. I'm going to let you go, though. Anything else you'd like to add before we send you back to the nice sunshine you're enjoying there?
Well, just thank you for being on the program and giving my column, my latest column, a plug. I hope people read it and at least consider it. It certainly will give the Prime Minister the opportunity to label me something or other, as he does anybody that speaks out against him. But I still appreciate taking part in some open debate and discussion about these issues because they're increasingly important to all Canadians.
You know, Jay, I just want to tell you, your column is actually going, I'm really saying this for the benefit of the listeners, the column runs at 7:30 tomorrow morning. And the other thing that I'll send you on your way with is that if Mr. Trudeau had not actually considered the possibility of going to 5 years, he read it in the Western Standard first, and it'll be your idea, sir.
You put the bug in. All right.
Well, the other thing that I talk about in the column is be careful what you wish for. If these protests were to get out of hand to where he could, you know, go to Mr. Singh and say, look, we've got to collectively impose the Emergencies Act again because this is open rebellion and we can't allow this unrest in Canada. And so then he could conceivably govern as long as he has the confidence of the House, as they say.
Right. Well, thank you for sharing your parliamentary wisdom with us, Jay, and your experience in the columns and on the show today. We'll have to get you back in the studio here once you get back up in the Great White North, assuming things have stayed stable enough for you to get back up here. So thank you very much, and I'm sure we'll be talking to you again soon.
Thank you.
So that was Jay Hill, who served a lot of time as a whip and a number of roles as a member of parliament. And yes, it's always good to hear from him because he's been on the front lines of all of that for a long time and can lend a lot of experience to these issues that people would rather not talk about quite often, to be honest. So getting on to the next one, a nice easy one. We're back to medical assistance and dying.
There's been a development
in that ongoing case with that gentleman and his daughter.
Yeah, he's filed to the Alberta Court of Appeal, which is kind of like the last stop before the Supreme Court to maintain the injunction. It's a really sad story. It's, you know, father trying, basically fighting for his daughter's life. And she's, you know, we were talking about this, you know, she's living in the basement. How do you have this conversation at the dinner table? You know, dad, I want to die. She's 27 years old. She's got autism. She's got ADHD. Those are just the things that we know about because she hasn't filed any documentation with the court over what her actual medical condition would be, like presumably to be approved for MAID. You have to have some kind of, life-debilitating kind of condition. Normally, we think it would apply more to old people for Alzheimer's or, you know, terminal cancer or something like that. But so he says she doesn't have the mental capacity to make the decision. He says any medical conditions she has are a result of undiagnosed psychological disorders. But the judge is basically saying it's not up to the courts to interfere in patient-doctor confidentiality, even though she had to shop around for a third doctor to actually get the approval, because you only need two. The star panel only takes two, you know, doctors or nurse practitioners to approve. So she went to one, he approved. She went to another, he disapproved. So they shopped around for the tiebreaker doctor. She was scheduled to die on February 1st, and he obtained the injunction the day before on January 31st to, like, last-ditch effort to kind of stop this. And his complaint in court, even though we're not allowed to identify them, is that AHS and College of Physicians and Surgeons have a duty of care to, you know, at least explain why this is happening, you know, and instead of just allowing it. AHS says, all we're doing is performing the procedure. It's a procedure, you know?
Yeah, cold.
Yeah, it's sad. It's a very sad state.
Well, you know, you have to feel sympathy for any young person who's having so little fun in life that they actually want to die. But, you know, if you read through your literature, you find that that angst is a recurring theme for centuries in popular novels. And the job is to keep them alive, to get them through it. Normally, it doesn't take until somebody is in their late 20s. But the idea, you know, there was another young woman, I think about the same age in Eastern Canada, who's just ended it all recently. And the danger of this seems like a cool way to go out and to create a little ripple as you go. The idea that this could be popularized is a frightening one to me, and it should be frightening to every parent who is trying to see their children into a healthy adulthood. Look, I mean, you said that we don't know everything.
Right.
What we know is not enough.
No.
to merit committing suicide.
Absolutely.
You know, get through it would be the message. It's a tough, you know, we've objected to I'm thinking back to the case of Annette Lewis, the woman who wanted an organ transplant, and they wouldn't put her on the table to do the job because she wouldn't take the vaccine, and eventually she died. And so we were quite upset when the medical profession made that decision. Well, here we're saying, well, do we want the judge making the decision instead of the medical profession? And it's hard to know who actually should have the last word on allowing somebody who is capable of living to choose death.
Yeah, absolutely. Are we going to extend it to people with Down syndrome? You know, like what qualifies? And I'm a little bit torn on this. I respect the fact that, you know, she's 27 years old. There was a spokesman from the Autism Society that said, you know, people with autism are quite capable of having, what do you call it? I don't know, autonomy, and, you know, in these kind of matters. You know, you and I were talking, like, you only have to be 16 years old in this province to have an abortion without parental consent. You have to be 18 to have a tattoo. You know, maybe 27 years old is old enough to be able to make those kinds of decisions or not. But what struck me, though, is that if you're going to put it up to a panel and they were supposed to follow some kind of objective guidelines, it seems fairly reasonable to me that they should be willing to be able to defend that decision in front of a professional body like the College of Physicians and Surgeons. Even though after I wrote the story, even though they had lawyers in the courtroom at that time, one of their spokespeople, you know, emailed me to kind of correct one of my articles and say, well, we are not directly intervening in this case. So they're kind of watching it, but they're not, you know, observing it. Whereas Alberta Health Services is, and this fellow's complaint is actually with Alberta Health Services, because what he's saying is that they're failing to live up to a duty of care because his daughter does not have the mental capacity to be able to make these decisions. And he thinks that it's actually AHS that should have to justify performing this procedure. And now the lawyers for AHS went up there and said, well, we make these decisions every day based on what the doctor says. We can't question the doctor. You know, we're making decisions to pull, you know, whatever, IVs and breathalyzers or breathing machines and these triage decisions all the time. And, you know, so the question is how does this become any different?
I'll tell you, that's a reassuring note. Next time you're going in for something, isn't it? You know,
just going to pull a plug on you. But yeah.
Look, the thing about it is that this was not what MAID was for.
I don't think so.
MAID, no, it wasn't. I mean, when they sold us on this package, they used the very sad case of a woman with
Sue Rodriguez.
And I think it was ALS. And she was
Sven Robinson.
Sven Robinson was there helping her. And the thing was, she was in excruciating pain. That's just about the most miserable way to go that I've ever been told about.
And it was terminal.
There was no coming back. So when she took the, whatever you think, whether you're for it or against it, you can see the logic of allowing somebody who is suffering terribly to end it now. It was never intended for people with mental illness or with autism or for psychological unrevealed programs. It just never was for that. And this is an expansion of an idea that is guaranteed to break somebody's heart.
Well, even the government is having second thoughts, because earlier this year they delayed expanding it for, you know, mental illness as a sole condition, you know, by at least 3 years while they were reviewing it. And this actually came up in the proceedings as well, is that it doesn't even seem like the government is comfortable with where this is going.
Well, the government is not comfortable about.
But they were the ones that brought it.
Where people think it's going, that's what they're not comfortable about. But the point is, right now the law does not. I'm reasonably certain I'm right about this, that because it's been backwards and forwards. I do believe the law does not support MAID for mental illness.
I hope not.
So if this is, if the justification for this case is that she's...
She would have other conditions. That's part of what we don't know necessarily.
Yeah.
Well, is autism considered to be a debilitating condition? Obviously, there's no cure for it. It's incurable. You know, maybe regular mental illness like alcoholism or something can be treated.
Right. Well, the term for autism is a spectrum. I mean, that goes from the point of somebody who has some marginal OCD to somebody who's completely debilitated and barely functional. So, I mean...
Or it can include somebody who can write a... Write a complex mathematical equation on a wall, and it
actually
means something.
Well, they can. They're really smart. My brother's son has autism, and he's a grade 8 piano. He's he's brilliant, but he can't go on an airplane. They have a hard time taking care of him in public, and he can't take care of himself.
Oh, it's going to be an ongoing and difficult discussion. We're getting down to our last couple of minutes, I fear. So we'll update and keep watching this as it unfolds. Maybe we'll just kind of machine gun hit really fast. The Alberta model, speaking about AHS, and for listeners outside of Alberta, that is Alberta Health Services. Premier Smith's got the new model. She's going to be splitting it up. Is it a good thing or a bad thing? I guess we'll hit fast here.
A good thing, especially with the approach to addictions treatment and mental health that was announced yesterday. It contrasts with British Columbia and the Safe Supply. It's we're talking 180, 180, 180. She made the comment that Alberta and British Columbia are basically an integrated drug market. So what happens there happens here. We've had an unacceptable level of deaths, but she's confident that splitting it up like this is going to bring them down.
I just love the basic life orientation of the Alberta approach. I mean, if you just go by the numbers, BC's numbers are going up, ours are going up. BC's numbers are going up more. Why? Because they give the stuff away.
It's almost hopelessness.
Yeah, you know, like just where here at least we are in Alberta, the government is trying to keep people alive, trying to make their lives better, trying to give them some hope of recovery and becoming useful citizens to themselves and those.
Well, the families as well, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's just sort of the difference.
Or even compared to this main thing.
Back to Maine.
Let's hope the initiatives pay off and Alberta leads by example and finally starts fixing part of Canada's very troubled healthcare system. Okay, and I'll just close out quickly with we had with the no guns grabbed. I'll just hit on that fast. Good news, bad news story. The good news is nobody's legal property and firearms have been seized by this federal government despite them wanting to, but they wasted $45 million in not seizing our firearms, so it's still money down the toilet. So there's the good news and the bad news out of it. And lots of other news we'll be covering throughout the week at the Western Standard, so be sure to get a membership if you haven't already, guys. It's $10 a month, $100 a year to help support us, keep getting those stories out there, those columns out there, and having these shows where we can discuss these things. So thank you very much, Sean and Nigel, for joining me today. Boy, we had a lot to get through. We covered the bulk of it, and we'll cover more of it next week, I guess. So.
And what fun it was.
All right. Thanks again, and thank all of you for tuning in. So, yes, tune in next week. We will see you again and with a whole new fresh set of issues.
Canadian Shooting Sports Association. Without the CSSA, our gun rights would have been taken long, long ago. These guys are on the front lines helping to draft smart and intelligent firearms regulations and legislation in Canada. And more importantly, educating the public about how we keep guns out of the hands of the wrong people. You become a member, it's absolutely worth every penny. You can become a Western Standard member for just $10 a month or $99 a year for unlimited access.